Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and journalist Casey Schwartz, and we're talking about her latest book, Attention, A Love Story. Casey, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book, although this is a very complex book. I want to give the audience in the best sort of way.
Oh, thanks, Mark. I'm so happy to be here.
This story starts out as an addiction story, an addiction to Adderall. And it's really funny. When I was in college, everybody was doing Dexedrine. Adderall's sort of a speed drug, too, like the people would take in college, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like Adderall is really just kind of the updated Dexedrine. Mm. And it came out in 1996. It hit the American markets then. And I was in high school. So I had barely heard of it, and I got to college, and a friend offered me one. It was my freshman year in college, and I had sort of like, you know, not read the book and not written the paper. Yep. And it was the night before, and she gave me this blue pill, and it ushered in this whole new era in my life because it felt like a silver bullet.
Now, Adderall has become popular because it was a treatment for ADHD, right?
Yeah, I mean, Adderall is prescribed for ADHD. But I think there's the problem with that diagnosis is that there's a lot of wiggle room around it.
Yeah, let's hold off on that for a minute because I want to bring you back and sure. Have that conversation because you did a lot of interesting research on that. For you personally, what did it feel like to be on Adderall?
It felt initially euphoric. It felt like I didn't need to sleep. It felt like my concentration was so superhuman that I could, you know, tackle these incredibly complicated texts like on the elliptical machine. Do you know what I mean? That my focus could go anywhere and it could do anything.
There's a phrase you use in the book, and I really like this, attention weaponized.
Yeah, it did feel like that. Like I popped a blue pill. And I could not be defeated by anything in the text in front of me. I could master that text.
But were you really mastering the text? Later in the book, I think it's Anjan Chatterjee, talks that Adderall makes you think that you're doing better and feel good while you're doing it, but it's like it makes you think you're doing better.
Right. I mean, initially, Adderall was sort of, you know, it was seen as, it's called like a cognitive enhancing drug, right? And then some research started coming out, especially out of Penn, saying, well, wait a minute, it may not improve performance in such a clear-cut way. It may not improve performance if you're already performing pretty well. It actually may sort of complicate performance. But it makes you feel really good. So you have the illusion that you are sort of doing better when you're on this pill.
The other thing you don't hear about Adderall is that it can be addictive. And you were addicted for how long?
I would round up and call it a decade.
Wow.
And yeah, and one of, it was so interesting because when I was initially this piece started as a piece in the New York Times Magazine in 2016. When I was reporting that, I remember calling someone whose career was in part dedicated to like the ethics of cognitive enhancement, such as Adderall. And he said to me, well, is it addictive? I mean, like he didn't even know, you know?
And wow.
It astonished me. And it's just so funny how disconnected that academic take can be from the experience sort of on the street. Because when that piece came out, I mean, I have gotten hundreds, possibly thousands of emails since of people who are just so trapped by this drug. They just feel they can't get out of this addiction.
Let's talk about your personal case. Did you try to give it up several times?
Yeah, I mean, like at first it started like a big love affair, you know, where I thought like, oh my God.
That's
my
like, life. It sounds like every addiction. It's like in the beginning it was great.
Right. In the beginning it's great. And you know, it is slightly different than other addictions because Adderall is presented as a tool for success. It's not about rebelling.
Wow. Well,
yeah. You know, it's about sort of succeeding and flourishing, right? It's a study drug after all. So it felt like, oh, great, I'll just sort of, you know, I'll take this and I'll do really well and it'll sort of help me get to my goals. And then as I got deeper into my 20s after college, I just had this creeping sensation like this is actually taking me farther
wow.
from my goals and more importantly from myself.
So what happened when you tried to withdraw?
I remember the first doctor I went to in my sort of early to mid-20s. I was then in graduate school, and I was so upset. And I because I felt like my life wasn't really my own anymore. And I showed up at his
right.
office, and he was so nice, and he put me on Wellbutrin, you know, which is sort of like an antidepressant and to help me get off the Adderall. And I wound up just taking both of them for like the next 6 years. Literally.
This sort of, and you find this out, this sort of seems to indicate to me that how little we actually know what is going on in our brains on these drugs.
I mean, I think the neural pathways are actually somewhat well understood. I mean, like any addictive substance, Adderall unleashes a torrent of dopamine, which is like
yep.
the feel-good neurotransmitter. But I definitely think that it's really hard to get people out of addictions. And I mean, and it's not just Adderall. I mean, we see it with all kinds of substances and all kinds of drugs in this country.
So what was the actual feeling both in your mind and your body when you were trying withdrawal?
Well, when I finally got to the point of getting off the Adderall, which was a good 10 years into the addiction, I was actually surprised that it wasn't as hard as I had imagined it was going to be. Like, I was tired. I was sluggish. I was a little bit all over the place. I was having trouble focusing for a few months. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like I was shaking on
right.
the sidewalk. You know, it was
right.
nothing like that. And I also noticed that there were sort of immediate pleasures associated with getting off Adderall, like I wasn't so anxious and urgent and stressed out. I was sort of like able to savor the sweeter aspects of the day and not just sort of be in that false amphetamine intensity.
You also had some paranoia about whether it had permanently done something to your brain or your mind.
Yeah, well, you know, the research is sort of out on whether you ever totally come back because when you're on a substance like Adderall, you know, your brain tries to compensate for that by stripping out its own dopamine receptors because you're getting so much of it from the drug. So there's this open question, like, is your brain going to reset or not?
Now, there's so much detail in that part of the book, which is just the beginning part of the book. But the fascinating thing is this becomes a quest by you to try to understand and learn more about the idea of attention. And that seems like, and it brings you some really wild places. Like you definitely go down the rabbit hole at one point in that quest. But attention is one of those things. Everybody uses the word, but I don't think anybody really knows what it is.
Well, there's a joke I guess this is like hilarious among attention researchers, but there's this sort of like
that's a really
paper.
Small group of people.
Right. But I think they all know about this paper called There Is No Such Thing as Attention by a researcher named Britt Anderson. And I think his point is that the term is used in so many different ways in like clinical sort of and scientific research that we struggle to define exactly what it is.
Well, let's start with ADHD because you actually go into some research about ADHD. It's often diagnosed now. I mean, there was a huge uptick in the diagnosing of ADHD at the end of the 20th century. But I think the thing that was disturbing to me is that you found out it wasn't. We still don't understand what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably an umbrella term for a lot of different...
Is it like a term that's actually describing the behavior, not the disease?
It could be. Yeah, I mean, there are some trademark brain differences that have been found in ADHD patients, but not all of them. And it's difficult to say, oh, well, this is causing that. So there's definitely ambiguity around this diagnosis. And I think I think the problem is that a lot of people feel that they are struggling to focus because we live in such a distracting time where there's so much information coming at us and it's coming from all directions. So I think it's actually very easy to think that you have ADHD and you may, you know, and I mean, I think I thought that I did, or I didn't exactly know. I mean, and that's how I sort of justified going out to get an Adderall prescription for myself.
Is it, do you have a feeling it's overdiagnosed?
Yes. I mean, I hope that's not too controversial a statement. But as, I mean, as a clinician, I can't really say, but I know that it can be diagnosed. I know from my own experience how easily it can be diagnosed, which is just simply sort of waltzing into a psychiatrist's office and waltzing out with an Adderall prescription 45 minutes later. So if that could happen to me, I know that, you know, that could happen to sort of anyone with the same amount of determination to get that diagnosis.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and journalist Casey Schwartz. And we're talking about her latest book. It's a really interesting read. Attention, a Love Story. Casey, what's the difference between concentration and attention?
Well, I think concentration is just that it's what they call top-down attention, which is when you're really like white-knuckling it to direct your focus. You're not, you know,
like a like a spotlight, like you're focusing
on
one.
But you're like effortfully throwing that spotlight on a target of your choosing. So the two big categories are top-down attention, when you make the voluntary, effortful decision to focus on something, and bottom up, which is like, you know, a car crash on the street, you automatically turn your head to pay attention to it. It's bottom up is like something grabs you.
Now, one of the things you investigate is our electronic devices, which seem designed to create poor attention, that seem to feed us, to make us more scattered in our concentration.
It's hard to deny that we're all that the rhythm of our thinking has changed, right?
Where we're I've seen it in friends. Like, if you're old enough and you're a person who are, you know, reads and stuff like that, and you have close friends, and all of a sudden every moment they're looking at their phone, that seems weird to me.
Yeah, and I mean it's tragic too. I mean, you know, Sherry Turkle, the brilliant MIT researcher, has found that just the presence of a phone on a dinner table can make that whole dinner conversation much more shallow. Because the thing is that everybody knows that at any moment a call or a text could come through, so they are less willing to be like sort of self-revealing and go deep. They'd rather just keep it shallow.
And it's like a constant diversion. You bring in a lot of authors into this book too, which I really liked, Aldous Huxley. And you talk about Brave New World, which was his sort of dystopia, which was all about people living in a world where everything is a distraction.
Right, where actually like being alone with your thoughts was considered horrifying in Huxley's story. Like the last thing you'd ever want to do is be alone with your thoughts.
Well, and you talk about this in the book. You went on a vacation on a Scottish island where there was no Wi-Fi and you sort of start to feel those, you know, withdrawal jitters. Like, what am I going to do? There's nothing to do here.
Mark, I remember that I was actually scared because it's like, what are we going to do? We're on this like little tiny Scottish, you know, Hebridean island.
Isn't that upsetting that you feel that way though? I mean, you're on this beautiful place that has...
Yes.
And yet you're feeling like...
20 years ago, it would have been no problem.
Yeah.
That goes to the deeper heart of the book, which is that I'm not like one of these digital detox gurus. Like, I'm suffering from exactly the same affliction as everybody else. Like, I'm on Instagram with everybody else. And I really wanted to look at that and try to understand that.
There's so many interesting authors and writers that you bring into this, and one of the quotes that really brought me up short and really made me think. I think it's, is it Simone Weil?
Yeah, it's actually pronounced Vey for some reason.
Okay. Attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity. And boy, did that make me rethink a lot of things.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I first saw that quote, I mean, I think it was 2013, and it just leapt off the page and just sort of like slapped me across the face.
You
never think of attention in terms of kindness and interpersonal relationships, right? Attention is talked about as this sort of workplace or academic commodity, but it actually has so much to do with like how we treat each other and how
You're
we
right.
behave towards one another. And I think that's actually its most important function. And so when I read that, I remember feeling a tidal wave of, of just like a jolt of recognition.
Well, you know, you talked about people putting the phone at the dinner table. That's a great example of what not to do. You know, you're there to have dinner with your family and pay attention to them. Put the stuff away. And it is a form of generosity, you know. And one of the authors you brought in, and it's a difficult author to talk about always, David Foster Wallace, mainly because most people haven't read Infinite Jest because it's so freaking huge.
Right.
Talk to me about why David Foster Wallace is in your book.
Totally. I mean, I knew going in, okay, I really want to include writers for whom attention was sort of a touchstone subject, like a sacred subject.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, like, what writer doesn't care about attention, right? But then gradually I realized, oh, there are actually some writers for whom attention became an obsession. And I think David Foster Wallace was the prime example of that. I think that even as he, at the older he got, the more obsessed with attention he became. And I mean, yeah, most people haven't read Infinite Jest, and I really put my own attention to work getting through it, as I talk about in the book. But
you have no problem with attention, kid, because you finished that book.
No, I love that book. But a lot of people have read or at least seen on YouTube the commencement speech he gave at Kenyon in 2005, and his whole theme is attention, because he's telling these college kids, attention, if you pay attention to the people around you, you can get yourself out of the most like dismal, sort of the most frustrating situations, because you can imagine yourself into their inner world and have this totally newfound compassion for what they might be going through. And he uses the example of being like stuck in a grocery line and you're so angry at the cashier and at the people in front of you, but if you really pay attention to these people, you can imagine yourself out of that situation and any situation. And it's a short speech on YouTube. I highly recommend. It's called This Is Water, and it goes to the heart of kind of what drew me to the subject myself.
We also asked the question why we recoil from the dull. And you talk about standing in the grocery line. That's a classic, you know, moment where not a lot is happening and everybody gets edgy. And you have to really start looking at it. Why am I doing that? Why am I feeling that feeling because nothing much is happening right now?
I mean, yeah, if you've ever been on a New York City subway when you emerge from a tunnel and suddenly the entire train is like grabbing for their phone like the second they possibly can. And you really do wonder, like, wow, what is so hard about just sitting here? That's kind of the beating heart of my book, that question. Like, why is it so hard and maybe getting harder by the moment for us to just sit with ourselves? And I think that's actually what connects attention and addiction, is like, why is it so hard to sit with myself without taking this pill? Or without reaching for my phone. What is so hard about that?
You also asked several other basic questions about attention. What is the point? I mean, very basic questions that people don't probably even think about because we just consider attention an everyday thing. But what is the point of attention? What did you learn about that?
I think you mean the sort of around the William James section.
Yep.
I mean, well, you know, attention shapes our lives because what we attend to is ultimately who we are. You know, it's what we do with our life. So attention is like one of those subjects that you think like, oh, attention, it's this very specific subject. And then you get into it and you realize, oh, no, attention is like one of the most massive subjects because it literally defines one's existence.
It also seems at times when you're talking to different researchers and theorists, it seems like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, in that the more you try to define attention, the more it seems to escape. That it's always on the periphery.
That's a great point.
It's like you can't. It's like everybody sort of knows what it is, but they can't really talk about it because then it's whatever that it's not. And you got some great examples of people who paid incredible attention. This made me like laugh. You talked about a group of European naturalists in the 18th century who just would pay incredible attention to insects.
Yeah, I mean,
that was incredible.
I know, like, I think one guy like sat for days counting every bee in a hive, and there were like something like 80,000 of them. I mean, but like, what was so funny is A, these guys were mocked in their time because everyone thought it was so inappropriate that like they were like directing such superhuman attention to like bees and worms and, you know, aphids and like these lowly repulsive.
Well, there was. I want to give him his due. Charles Bonnet in Geneva spent 21 consecutive days staring at one aphid.
Right.
That's attention, man.
And then he was like devastated when he lost track of it.
I can imagine. Oh my God.
The thing is that like he had sort of fallen in love with it.
Oh.
You know, because through the sheer force of attention, I think you can become enamored with anything.
Is the problem of attention a modern problem? You talk to people, I think it's Titchener, or maybe he was a writer, that talked about that being a modern problem.
I think that it's not new to worry about attention. Like, I think people at the end of the 19th century were worried about attention. When movies became big, people were worried about their attention. When industrialization hit, and there were workers in factories having to be so vigilant, you know, all through the workday on the factory line, like attention was considered a problem. So we're not new in thinking, you know, and feeling sort of scattered and threadbare and worried about our attention. But I do think that the way we're living now and the devices that we have has ratcheted up the fever pitch of this distraction.
Well, it is amazing to me, you know, when I travel around the world and we're in some incredible spot, everybody is taking pictures through their phone and nobody's actually looking at the object. And when I've seen that I've seen that countless times. So nobody's actually enjoying the moment. They're recording the moment so that they can probably enjoy it later. You're not really there when you're doing that.
Yeah, and actually there's like fascinating research on the connection between attention and memory. Because if you, the more distracted that you are in any given moment, the less able you are later to remember that moment. And that's like a very well-known neuroscientific finding. So what, I mean, I find for me, that was a very like sort of clarifying, research, finding, because it says like attention, it's not just relevant for the quality of our present moment. It's relevant for our future too.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I just want to mention that there's a whole section of this book where you get involved with people taking microdoses. And that got weird.
Yeah, I mean, I was so fascinated by the whole like psychedelic science community because it's this, you know, it's emerging movement, and the whole idea of it is that we're not living quite right? I mean, that's what the implication and the subtext is of this surging psychedelic moment. We could be living better. And I became convinced, and because actually one of the most popular reasons why people microdose LSD or ayahuasca or mushrooms is for distraction. And I really wanted to probe that a little bit more because I kind of became convinced that part of what's drawing people to psychedelics is this feeling of never being quite in the moment in their normal life.
And they're looking for that.
I think they're craving it desperately.
Or are they trying to distract themselves from the state of the reality today, which is pretty grim.
I mean, that's a totally valid point, too. But my feeling was that people were trying to get to a deeper truth through psychedelics, and trying to better understand more than they were trying to escape. But that, I mean, of course, how can one generalize?
And that's a wild section in your book. You fully own up to that. that thing where there's a big group meeting and everybody's dosing. Were you in South America or something?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but the funny thing is, Mark, is like it's so, like, I kind of think it's like on the verge of being so mainstream. I don't even see it as like so crazy. But
well, I lived through the 60s, so I saw that and was part of that.
We're here again, but now they're like funding it for millions of dollars at prestigious universities.
See,
it's like psychedelic research.
Oh my God, it's like all coming around again. I should break out my bell bottoms in my.
You're ready.
No. Well, maybe I won't. I won't shut that door. Getting back to attention. I think it was you that said if we paid attention to everything all the time, we'd be in hell. Or did somebody else say that?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually literally impossible, right?
You can't, because if you had to do that, we wouldn't be able to function.
And I think that's why there's always this idea of, like, attention as this unattainable, perfectible, you know, you could always be this sort of monk in a monastery with this perfect attention.
Yeah, but we're living in the real world. We gotta stop because we're out of time. There's so much more crammed in this book too, by the way. I want to mention to everybody, it's a deceptively small book. There's a lot in there. My guest tonight has been writer and journalist Casey Schwartz, and we've been talking about her latest book. It's a fascinating read, Attention, a Love Story. Casey, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Well, this has been Mark Lynch. You're listening to Inquiry. Good night.